Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning. It's the show on 91.5, along with Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later this hour, what happens when a political consultant gets a lot of power that he didn't have before? Plus, there are three bills going through the state legislature that aim to help schools recruit and retain teachers.
But first, Maricopa County is number one in terms of annual population growth. The U.S. Census Bureau today says Maricopa added the most people between July of 2015 and July of last year, more than 81,000 people or 222 people each day. Harris County, Texas, saw the second biggest population gains over that time. To understand what this means, I'm joined by economist Jim Rounds of Rounds Consulting. And Jim, first off, what do you make of these numbers?
Well, I have to say that this was expected. Arizona and the greater Phoenix area was always a really solid long-term economic bet. The problem was we had a downturn a few years back that disproportionately impacted us, so the numbers were a little bit lower than what we would normally see. But we're getting back to where we should be, and so I'm optimistic, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, this is a place that is sort of predicated on population growth, and as you said, it had slowed down for a while. Do you expect that where it is now is where it will ultimately be? Do you expect it to go higher, lower?
I think the numbers are going to be picking up even more, and I think this will be the case across the country, but it's going to impact states like Arizona and then our local region even more so. Individual household balance sheets are in better shape than they used to be. People not only have jobs, but they're working more hours, they're making more money. And so it wasn't just an issue in Arizona and Greater Phoenix where people weren't moving. It was an issue across the country. So you're going to see more population flows everywhere, and that's going to impact some of these growth states like Arizona and then the local region here, which is a big portion of the state's economy.
Why do you think it is that people are starting to move back to Maricopa County, to the Phoenix area, in the numbers they are now?
So it starts with basic things. Does somebody want to live here? When they're having a hard time financially, it's hard for them to move. And when the local economy isn't creating that many jobs, good opportunities, because somebody that typically moves here is looking for a job, it slows the growth rate. But our economy is growing more rapidly. We're a top 10 state in terms of a broad-based economic growth, and we will be top 5 probably by next year. And so it's the underlying economics that's supporting this growth. And we're looking at this improving over the next couple of years. So I think you're going to see an improvement in the numbers, even though they're currently impressive compared to others.
So let me ask you sort of the chicken and the egg question here, which is, are people moving here because the economy here is better, or is the economy better here because more people are moving here?
That's actually a good question, and it's both. So part of our economy, because we've been a popular location, we've been a location of choice, part of our economy is based on this growth continuing. And when growth slowed during the last recession, you really saw the impact on the economy. So we're seeing a pickup in people wanting to move here. We're seeing decent job creation numbers. So you have components of both. And because of the balance sheet issue, individuals in better shape across the country, us doing a pretty good job of creating not just local market jobs, but also those base sector jobs, the manufacturing, the research-oriented ones, I think that our position is going to improve even more so.
Well, on the jobs front, earlier this week, we saw numbers from ASU that showed Phoenix cracked the top 10 metro areas in the country for a year-over-year job growth in 2016. That seems to sort of support what you're saying about the economy better here, people moving here, almost sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy of creating more jobs.
Yeah, and you have to look at these basic economic indicators. You know, there's all sorts of things that you can look at, but the ones that you want to look at for the state are things like population growth and employment growth. You can look at tax collections and other things like that, but those are the two that really dictate the extent that we're growing. And then you look at income figures. Are we growing high wage jobs as another one? And I think we're starting to see all of these figures inch up. I don't think we're going to have this massive economic boom period. I think that we're going to see only moderate growth the rest of this expansion. But this isn't unique to the Phoenix area. It's not unique to Arizona. This is just the nature of the overall U.S. expansion. And so in relative terms, we're doing quite well.
Do you think that Maricopa County is equipped in terms of sort of the foundation of the economy, services, things like that? Are we equipped to take in 222 people a day, which is what the Census Bureau averaged out are coming to Maricopa County?
Yeah, so here's the thing in terms of the growth. You can be number one in a particular category, but if you're comparing yourselves to other areas that are growing slowly, yes, you might be number one, but it's not impressive growth. That's kind of the situation now. We're growing at about 2% according to the census figures, but normally we'd be growing around 3% or even north of that. So in terms of our ability to accommodate this growth, absolutely. In fact, we can probably grow even more rapidly because we need more basic workers for, you know, to work in housing, to work in some of the other basic industries, not necessarily just the high wage jobs.
So we're number one, but don't break out the streamers and the party hats just yet.
Yeah, we need to ramp it up and compete with at a higher rate. But let's be optimistic, though. It's been tough times the last few years, and we're getting to where we should be. Number one isn't as impressive as maybe we would like it to be, but we're moving in the right direction. And what that does, what's important for me, is that supports the broader story that we're still a good economic bet.
That's economist Jim Rounds with Rounds Consulting in Tempe. Today in Washington, Congress is expected to vote on the American Health Care Act, the Republican-proposed replacement for Obamacare. But here in Arizona, supporters of Planned Parenthood will be rallying throughout the state to protest against the GOP's efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Rallies are planned today and tomorrow here in Phoenix at the state capitol, as well as at Senators Flake and McCain's offices in Tucson and Representative Martha McSally's office and in Flagstaff. And we're joined now by Jody Liggett of Planned Parenthood Arizona to talk more about these rallies. Good morning, Jody.
Good morning.
So what's the goal?
Well, I think the goal is for citizens of Arizona who support Planned Parenthood to make their voices heard, and they feel like they're not being listened to right now. And we're finding this across the country. Poll after poll has shown that a majority of Americans, including Republicans and Democrats, support Planned Parenthood and don't want to see it defunded.
How do you go about trying to get that argument across? It seems like there are a lot of members of Congress who are fairly certain about where they stand on this bill. How do you try to convince the ones you need to convince?
Sure. Well, I think we're willing to sit down and talk with anybody. We do that. We travel back to Washington, D.C. and speak with members and their staff who agree to meet with us. I do think we and our constituents are not feeling heard. The last recess, you saw that, you know, there weren't very many town halls around the state, and those that were held were in pretty remote areas. We think our members are hiding out from their constituents a little bit, particularly in the majority. So that's when you see people take to the streets, go to the Capitol, have a rally, show up at offices, bringing petitions. That's the great part about our country. There are a lot of ways that you can make your voice heard, and that's what our people are doing.
In your mind, is the American Health Care Act amendable to the point where you'd be okay with it, or is this bill as a whole just not going to work?
Wow. We, like many, many people on the right and the left, we think that Congress should start over. This is a hastily patched together bill that is not going to meet the objectives, you know, even of the sponsors. It's not going to lower premiums. It's not going to cover more people. The Affordable Care Act could certainly use improvements. That's the case with any big landmark legislation, right? But we've had years of gridlock and haven't been able to make those improvements. And we really think that Congress should go back to the drawing board, listen to their constituents, and start over.
All right. That's Jody Liggett of Planned Parenthood Arizona. Jody, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
The Trump administration has been very clear in its efforts to fight and even undermine traditional media outlets and news sources. One of the people who's been especially out front as a voice for the administration in that vein is Kellyanne Conway, currently counselor to President Trump. It was quite a climb for Conway, as a recent conversation on NPR's Morning Edition between host Rachel Martin and Molly Ball of The Atlantic indicated.
How did she end up in Donald Trump's orbit, at the center of it, really?
Well, it's funny. You know, I've known Kellyanne for many years because she's been sort of a mid-level, you know, Republican consultant and flack. She was not a big deal before she signed up with what ended up being a winning presidential campaign. She worked for Newt Gingrich in 2012. She's sort of been, you know, in that middle tier of consultants.
That progression isn't necessarily unique for political consultants, but I wanted to get the perspective of an Arizonan who had a fairly similar trajectory on the local level. Chuck Coughlin, president of High Ground Consulting, has worked for Senator John McCain and former Governor Fife Symington, but he became especially influential with former Governor Jan Brewer. Coughlin is with me to talk about political communication and moving up the ladder in political consulting. Chuck, what do you make of the aggressive offensive the Trump administration has been on against traditional media sources?
Steve, this has been, we're in a tumultuous political period. More and more people are not affiliating with parties. They're getting their messages from different sources of media. The electorate has been diced and divided so many different ways. It's hard to say where it's going to go. It really is. But, you know, from a historical perspective, what we've always tried to do, the experience that I've tried to do with our clients and the governors that we've worked for, elected officials that we work for, is, hey, we want to talk about what we want to talk about. And so the media may want to talk about other things, but we want to talk about what we want to talk about, whether that's when we're with Governor Brewer and talking about the budget deficit when she took office and the ability to raise sales taxes, to the, you know, the dialogue around 1070 and the immigration debate. We knew what we wanted to talk about. Sometimes we weren't able to talk about that because there were, particularly the best example of that was probably during the immigration discussion. The messaging that we try and tell our clients is, let's stick to our yoga mat. Let's talk about what we want to talk about and then discipline ourselves when there's other opportunities or other things being talked about. Maybe have two or three talking points, but those are bridge messages back to what we want to talk about. We try and discipline everybody to say, this is, you know, we know what you want to talk about, but I'm going to use what you want to talk about what we need to talk about. What is missing to me in this current administration is, what do they want to talk about? I mean, you have to have concrete proposals.
You were a major strategist for Governor Brewer. With Kellyanne Conway, she is someone who had worked for candidates. A lot of people are giving her credit for helping Donald Trump become president. And so I'm wondering, from one standpoint, how influential does that sort of number one consultant, advisor, whatever it may be, because you were with Governor Brewer, it was definitely Chuck Coughlin and Jan Brewer in many ways strategically seeming joined at the hip. So I wonder, how much synergy does there have to be between the elected official and the most trusted advisor or advisors? And also, what happens when you go from being a person who's doing very well, but then you move to an even higher level? How do you balance that in the world of politics?
First of all, in this business, in the business that Kellyanne is in and the business I'm in, elected officials value loyalty more than almost any other quality, because it's their name. It's their name. It's their name on the ballot. It's their name up top. And if you're publicly positioning yourself as something more important than them or a different point of view than they've expressed, you better be very, very careful how you do that. I've obviously had deep disagreements with Governor Symington and Governor Brewer over the time, from working for Senator McCain back in the day to Matt Salmon to Grant Woods. You better express those privately, never publicly. When I see successful administrations, I see people that reward loyalty but encourage candor when the door's closed. That presents a lot of difficult emotional, intellectual challenges for somebody in that space. You have to have a deep admiration for that person, and you have to have deep respect for them, because it's your reputation too, as you said with Kelly and myself. I was fortunate enough to have long relationships with both of the governors that I spoke of earlier, so I knew who they were. I know them as people. I admire them. I would say I love them both. I'm not sure she's known him quite as long as I've known those officials. I think she was working for Ted Cruz's super PAC at one point before moving over. But she understands that loyalty factor.
And Chuck, what about the other part of the question? When you move up the ladder, you get in a very powerful position, you probably become real confident in your views, and you also take some of the slings and arrows. What is that like?
Yes. people in the public environment, very rarely does then somebody then go after the president himself or the governor themselves. People who disagree with them then tend to take on the surrogate, tend to take on the other person to try and create a wedge between that in that relationship. And so that's just the nature of politics, is people aren't going to criticize the king. They're going to criticize the king's advisors, or the queen's advisors, if you will.
Chuck Coughlin is president of High Ground, based here in Phoenix, public affairs consultants. Chuck, thanks for the insight. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for the opportunity.
In a check of news from KJZZ at 9:28, a group of Tohono O'odham tribal members will voice their opposition to President Donald Trump's proposed border wall outside Senator John McCain's Tucson office later today. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports.
The Tohono O'odham Nation shares 75 of the 270 miles of the U.S.-Mexico border. The fear among some members is that a wall will prevent tribal members from moving back and forth across the border and disrupt wildlife migration patterns. Gabriela Cáceres Kelly is a member of the group Indivisible Tohono, which organized the rally. She says another big issue is the militarization of borderlands.
So that means we're having a lot more strangers on our lands. And it opens us up to racial profiling, civil and human rights violations, and that sort of thing.
Indivisible Tohono also wants Senator McCain to formally oppose the wall and to introduce legislation that will reverse federal waivers that would allow construction without the need for environmental studies. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 with Mark Brody, Lauren Gilger, and the takeaways Todd Zwillick. I'm Steve Goldstein. A new report from the Associated Press says that Donald Trump's former campaign chairman Paul Manafort reportedly paid for consulting work on behalf of Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Back in April, the embattled Manafort was arguing his case on TV and fighting a lot of internal battles with other Trump officials behind the scenes, and it's not over for him.
Now, Paul Manafort left the campaign in August. The campaign at that time wasn't going so well for Donald Trump, and Manafort's connections, his very lucrative connections to pro-Russian Ukrainian politicians and Putin-connected Russian oligarchs, were getting too many headlines for Mr. Trump's comfort. Those kinds of headlines are back now, though, and it's not campaign season anymore. Congressional committees and the FBI are now actively investigating Russia's attempts to influence the presidential election. Connections and even possible collusion between Trump campaign officials and Russians is a focus. And once again, Paul Manafort is at the center of the media leaks. Anyway, the Associated Press is reporting this week that Manafort signed a $10 million contract with a Russian billionaire in 2006, intended to advance the interests of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Treasury officials are reportedly tracing Manafort's business transactions with Russians through offshore banks. Now, they call this phenomenon in Washington drip, drip, drip. The news on Manafort and the broader Russia investigation is dripping all over the president and his agenda. There's a major health care bill on the House floor today. Matthew Nussbaum is White House reporter at Politico. He's been following all of the story on Paul Manafort. Welcome, Matthew.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Do we know how the investigation into Paul Manafort, his past activities and his possible activities during the campaign, fits into the broader picture? Because Manafort, of course, is not the only Trump campaign official under investigation.
That's right. So we don't yet know how any of this really all fits together. There are a number of Trump associates and Trump campaign officials who have these ties that have been revealed either to Russia or to WikiLeaks, which, as we now know, was leaking documents that were provided by Russia. So all these questions are there. There's a lot of data points out there, but we don't yet know how they all connect. There are two congressional investigations, the FBI investigation, that are all trying to put this together. So there's three investigations, at least, that we know of, that are trying to find out if this stuff all connects and how it all connects.
Let's go back in time just for a minute, because Paul Manafort's activities in the campaign are clearly an issue, but his history in Ukraine with pro-Russian Ukrainians and with Russians themselves is probably an issue as well, and this goes back to the mid-2000s.
That's right. So this is a Republican political operative, Paul Manafort, who had worked on a number of presidential campaigns. But then he had these stints lobbying on behalf of foreign governments, particularly the Ukrainian government and the pro-Russian leader there, Viktor Yanukovych. And we know that he received, or at least was slated to receive, large sums of money for this work. And now we know that the work wasn't just confined to pro-Russian forces within Ukraine, but also was done for Russia itself.
And when we flash forward now to President Trump in the White House, there is this sense from Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, and White House officials that they never really knew Paul Manafort all that well and that they couldn't have known about these connections. Listen.
To suggest that the president knew who his clients were from a decade ago is a bit insane. He was not a government employee. He didn't fill out any paperwork attesting to something. There's nothing that he did that suggests at this point that anything was nefarious.
Well, first, it's worth noting that this whole idea that there was nothing nefarious here is a little bit dubious, because when you're lobbying on behalf of a foreign government, you are supposed to register with the Justice Department. And according to the AP, there's no indication that this work that he was doing for this Russian billionaire to improve Putin's image, to improve the Russian government's image, was registered with the Justice Department. But what we're seeing is the White House is trying to run away from Paul Manafort as quickly as they possibly can. Sean Spicer saying earlier this week that he played a limited role on the campaign for a limited time. Of course, he managed the campaign through the convention, through a critical time in the campaign. And we know that when he left the campaign in August, that was not the end of his relationship with Donald Trump. They continued to be in touch, we know, through the election and even into the transition period. So this attempt that they're making to say, oh, he was just a bit player on the campaign, won't work the way it will for some of these other people who have come under scrutiny for their Russia connections.
And what does it mean now as we move forward, Matthew Nussbaum, that Treasury officials are looking into Manafort's overseas transactions through offshore banks?
Well, it just raises more questions. It just puts more of a cloud over the White House, and you have this continued drumbeat, and it's a bipartisan drumbeat. This is not just a Democratic witch hunt the way the White House has tried to make it out to be, for more information and for more investigations. Senator John McCain, who everybody knows, staunch Republican, is calling for an independent investigation. He says that the House Intelligence Committee has lost credibility in doing this investigation. He wants to see an independent committee formed to investigate it. The more information like this that comes out, the more we're going to see Republicans and Democrats alike calling for an independent investigation into what happened here.
Matthew Nussbaum, White House reporter at Politico. Thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thank you.
And that's Todd Zwillick with The Takeaway. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein and Lauren Gilger. I'm Mark Brody. The statewide teacher shortage has been at the focus of Arizona politics for years now. Currently, there are still more than 2,000 teacher vacancies in our state, and other states have been actively trying to recruit our teachers out of Arizona.
But there are three bills going through the state legislature now that aim to help our schools recruit and retain teachers. So to start with, we have SB 1038, which would create a pilot program for professional development for teachers. It would give teachers access to $2,000 so they could get additional credentials and certifications to teach in high-need content areas. I spoke with Aaron Hart, Chief Operating Officer of education nonprofit Expect More Arizona. More about this.
So this is a great benefit to teachers, and in return, they would pledge to teach for 3 years once they get that certification. So it could be a great tool that we haven't had in Arizona before.
And what else do we have on the docket?
Sure. There's a couple other bills. These two are actually working together to expand the current math and science and special education teacher loan forgiveness program, and it's going to expand it to include teachers who want to serve in low-income schools, rural schools, and tribal schools as well. So I think what these two bills are both trying to do is to look at the larger teacher recruitment and retention issue in the state and provide some opportunities for teachers to have their student loans forgiven so that it makes their ability to afford the teacher salary a little bit more bearable. And also pilot program, it helps them continue their education as well.
So looking at this package of bills going through, in light of the teacher shortage, 2,000-something open teacher jobs in the state, why do you think these are so important right now?
Well, I think you hit the nail right on the head. We have a really big issue right now in Arizona, and this should be our top priority as a state, is making sure that we've got a great teacher in every classroom. And right now, like you mentioned, we have a pretty significant shortage. And in addition to what you mentioned, there's also another 2,200 teacher positions that were filled using some alternative pathways. So that all adds up to a lot of teachers and a lot of kids who, aren't getting the great education they deserve. I think schools are doing the very best that they can. and they're really trying to make it work. But, you know, I think we need to zoom out and look at the long-term solution for how we're going to get there. How are we going to support teacher pay? How are we going to support ongoing professional development and student loan forgiveness and other programs like these that we've been talking about so that teachers really feel good and feel supported in their careers?
Right. And we've had a lot of attention on this issue in the last several years. Prop 123 went through and was approved by voters, and that was sort of a joint initiative by the governor and by many education organizations to try and get some of that funding back into education. Do you think that it's done enough?
Well, Prop 123 was important for us, for Arizona, because it did put additional funds back into schools. However, if we just think about why it was necessary and why it happened, is it was a settlement to give schools funding that they were owed. So many schools use those to address their most pressing needs, of which included, for many, supporting teacher pay. And when we think about teacher pay, most recent data puts Arizona ranked at 50th when you look at teacher pay adjusted for cost of living. So Arizona is at the bottom of the heap. So all things considered, we've got a long way to go to make progress, to make sure that our teachers are compensated fairly and feel good about being in the teaching profession.
Teacher pay is a big part of this. It sounds like a couple of these bills will try to at least alleviate some of the student loan debt so that the teacher pay might be more amenable, more livable, I guess. Do you think it does enough?
I think these are good steps in the right direction. I think we need to look at the issue comprehensively with teachers included at the table and look at what it would take. And we know that these issues to keep and attract great teachers into the classroom, it's more than just about pay. It's about how does the community support them? What kind of support do they get when they first get into that classroom? It's often called mentoring and induction, right? Do they have a coach, someone they can rely on? What are their working conditions like? Are they slaving, you know, 60, 70 hours a week? And what's their life like? You know, are they able to have some work-life balance? So all of those things go into the puzzle of teacher recruitment and retention that we need to work on. So these are good steps in the right direction, and we need to do more things like this to make sure teachers feel supported in the classroom.
Right. And I know other states are actively, like Nevada, right, is actively recruiting Arizona teachers, saying, come here, we have better benefits for you, better pay, our school system is better funded. If these are the first steps, what's next that Arizona needs to do to recruit and retain good teachers?
Well, I think we need that long-term solution for teacher pay. That is a big issue, and it's a top priority, not just for, you know, our organization, but for Arizona voters. They have told us time and time again that this is a really important priority of theirs. And that's coming from both sides of the aisle, right? So everybody knows and recognizes that this is an issue that we all want to work on together. And I think folks at the Capitol feel the same way. It's just an issue of where's the money going to come from. And then we need to look at similar programs for how do we support mentoring and induction programs in schools across Arizona? How do we make sure that teachers who want to pursue additional certification called National Board Certification, those are like the top tier teachers in the state, how can we support them and how can we incentivize them to get that additional support and certification? Those are some of our best teachers in Arizona, so we want to support them as much as we can. So things like that will help us move the needle.
Erin Hart with Expect More Arizona, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
You bet.
Some doctors are operating on hands in a new way, with the patient wide awake. It eliminates the risks and side effects of general anesthesia. But the technique has been slow to catch on in the U.S. because of a decades-old myth about the dangers of injecting adrenaline into hands. From the Arizona Science Desk, Melissa Siveny reports for KJZZ on how that's starting to change.
A lot of people wouldn't want to watch a doctor cut open their hand. But for Rita Stuckey of Prescott, getting to watch her own operation for arthritis was actually pretty great.
I watched him make the incision. I watched him drill. I watched him pull out big pieces of bone. I didn't feel one, you know, even twinge of pain. And yet I got to see clearly how it was done.
Wide-awake hand surgery requires a shot of adrenaline to reduce bleeding and give the doctor a clear view. It's a new idea for doctors who were taught for decades never to inject adrenaline into hands. Canadian surgeon Don Lalonde helped prove that fear is unfounded. It's based on a myth kept alive for half a century by outdated textbooks and memorable rhymes.
Never put adrenaline into fingers, nose, penis, and toes. You'd have to be the world's biggest dummy to not remember it.
The myth came from the 1940s when a few dozen people lost fingers to gangrene after surgery. Adrenaline took the blame, but it was just an innocent bystander. Lalonde says the real culprit was bad procaine, the only anesthetic available at the time.
The reason that they didn't know about this is because they didn't have expiry dates before 1972. So in the old days, you could have a bottle of procaine sitting on your shelf for 10 years.
Because of this misconception, doctors use tourniquets instead of adrenaline to reduce bleeding. Tourniquets are so painful, patients have to be asleep. But that's starting to change. Flagstaff surgeon John Durham was the first to bring wide-awake hand surgery to Northern Arizona.
It's been a game changer for me in terms of treating my patients. There's a newness to it and a freshness to the technique that also offers, I think, a lot of benefits.
The procedure is less expensive, for one thing. Patients don't have to fast before their surgery, and they can leave the hospital right away without feeling groggy or nauseous. Durham says he can even have them test the repair work on the spot to make sure everything went well.
They're participating through the whole thing, and so there's no missing time. They know what happened. They know something was done. And many times they got to see exactly what was done, and I think that's beneficial to them. I think they're recovering better with that knowledge of what happened to them.
Rita Stuckey, who just had wide-awake hand surgery, agrees.
It really is like going to the dentist. Zips up, you're in, they do the stuff, you're out, you go home, you eat lunch, you do whatever you want to do.
Stuckey says she knows change happens slowly in the medical world, but there's reason to think the old myth about adrenaline's dangers really is gone for good. Last year, the American Association for Hand Surgery held its annual conference in Scottsdale. It included, for the first time ever in the United States, an all-day course on wide-awake hand surgery. I'm Melissa Siviny in Flagstaff.
Good morning. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org with Lauren Gilger and Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Later this hour, how many physical books should a library have on its shelves? And we'll hear about life on the set of a film shot here in the Valley where the crew was made up of Hollywood pros and ASU students.
We start with Sister Claire Dunn, who was the first Catholic nun to be elected to public office in 1975 when she entered the Arizona legislature as a representative from Tucson. And she was one of the last. The Vatican has since stopped allowing nuns to run for office.
But she wasn't there to sing in the choir. Sister Claire was a liberal lion in the conservative Arizona legislature who was going to Phoenix to struggle for social justice, she said. She fought for immigrants, women and children, prisoners' rights, Arizona's water rights, and she was critical of the majority party for their ties to special interests.
But in the middle of her seventh term, she and her legislative aide, Sister Judith Lovechick, were killed in a car crash on the I-10. Now more than 35 years after her death, Sister Claire is being inducted into the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame.
Sister Claire was a really unforgettable person, so much so that the woman who nominated her for the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame was her student decades ago when she taught her government in high school in Tucson. Nora Booth said Sister Claire was an inspiration to her. Now she is a freelance writer and teacher herself in Tucson, but she says she remembers how passionately Sister Claire taught them all those years ago. Booth has been researching Sister Claire to write a book about her, and when I spoke with her more about her former teacher, I asked her about how this Democratic Catholic nun was welcomed into the Arizona legislature when she arrived back in 1975.
Well, I don't think she was very warmly welcomed by the opposition when she came. She would come to these meetings and it would always be all men on the committee and herself, and they would be smoking cigars and ignoring her, and she really wouldn't have any of that. So her tactic there was to go and learn everything she could and be the most educated in the room every time on whatever bill was there. There was an example when they had a bill that was coming up, and it was a banking bill. And she said, if you pass that bill, it will cost the state a huge amount of money. And they just ignored her, and they did, and it was. And then they came back and reformed the committee, and she wasn't on it. So, you know, she got this kind of treatment.
But she was really well respected in the end by her colleagues, Republicans and Democrats alike.
Yes, yes. And it really came to them saying that very, very clearly after the two women were killed.
Right, and they eulogized her as the quote-unquote conscience of the legislature, is that right?
Yes. I have something here that Skelly said. She really lived her religion. She tried to use the system to help those getting a raw deal, the poor, the minorities, the downtrodden. She worked her tail off for them. I literally loved her. Forget that she was a tremendous legislator. She was just one of the nicest people I've ever known.
And that's from a Republican colleague of hers?
That's from Jim Skelly, yes.
And you knew her, Nora. You were one of her students at Sal Point. And I wonder, what are some of your memories of her?
Well, my fondest one is when she first came. She was in the hallways, and it was the first day of classes. And she came just through the doors and started walking down the hall. She had this really fast and purposeful walk. And we were all staring. She was in full nun clothing, and she had these white tennis shoes on. It was very irregular. We all followed her in and thought this is going to be fun, and it was. So we talked about all kinds of things all the time. I mean, she was a political science major, and, you know, she really believed that we had a mission as people to take care of everyone, and that those who were advantaged had to do something for others. You know, we had to give. We had to be concerned about them. It was just something that all of us that were her students really, you know, she changed my life.
So tell us, why did you want to nominate her for the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame?
It's very appropriate, a recognition of her contributions to Arizona. First, there were hundreds of students that she taught, and then she did this work in the legislature, and it had a lot to do with, you know, just her being there. I think that she was very disappointed and discouraged that she didn't accomplish more, you know, that she didn't have more bills that were passed. But, you know, honestly, in that legislature, Democrats don't get bills passed. You know, that's not the way it works. But people just loved her. They trusted her. She went door to door. She had these campaigns that took her door to door. And she brought sisters over. She had her students working. Her students were running the campaign. And involving the sisters and having that power behind her was really, really important.
So today the state legislature is still very much like that. What do you think she would think of the divisiveness that still exists in politics today?
Oh, she would be just as vocal about it and just as, you know, angry about it. Enraged is the term that she used. You know, why are we doing this? Why are we wasting this time and you know, this precious time that we have here to do things? You know, what is our mission, really? She realized that the only place to touch power was from the inside. That's what she said. So that was one of the reasons she wanted to do this.
And do you think that even though she didn't get more bills passed, she really was able to make a difference?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think she was, you know, as I said, the conscience of this. Here's something she said. In 1979, after 4 years in office, she addressed a gathering of her order regarding her, quote, somewhat unprecedented decision to run for public office. It was not an easy decision. I hated to leave the classroom, and my superiors, understandably, had many concerns. But courage, or perhaps I should say rashness, triumphed, and we moved together into a new and untested response to human need. If my continuation in the legislature were predicated on my legislative victories, I would be long gone. But I know that in the paradoxes of the gospel, winning is often losing, and losing winning. Though the experience has been largely one of frustration and discouragement, I believe that in some mysterious way I am making the gospel present here.
Nora Booth is a writer and teacher from Tucson who nominated Sister Claire Dunn for the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame. Nora, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Lauren, it's been really great to talk to you. She was incorruptible, and people should know about people like that.
Sister Claire Dunn's induction ceremony into the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame will take place this afternoon at 3 p.m. at the Arizona Heritage Center in Papago Park.
The Trump administration's proposed federal budget doesn't leave any room for the National Endowment for the Arts or the National Endowment for the Humanities, completely eliminating all of their funding. At this point, the annual budgets for both collectively reach $300 million and a $1.1 trillion total of annual federal discretionary spending. Arts organizations in many communities were alarmed by the proposed zeroing out and are moving to take steps to counter the idea. To learn more, I'm joined by Bob Booker. He's executive director of the Arizona Commission on the Arts. Bob, why do you think the administration is proposing these cuts?
Well, surely it has nothing to do with the budget. The NEA is, I believe, 0.004% of the federal budget. So, quite frankly, that's a red herring to say that these are going to save the budget. I think what it says, quite frankly, is it sends a message that diminishes the importance of culture, heritage, ethnicity, literature, the fine arts, the community arts, folk arts, across America. It sends a message that says this administration does not value this. This administration actually would rather see this conversation go away. All things that are troubling to someone who spent their career working in the arts and as an artist.
When we think about the fact that post-recession, many arts groups have said it's been harder to get individuals, corporate donors to give to those services which provide artists opportunities to entertain, to inform the community. Mm-hmm. Is that a slippery slope as well? Is it going to be that much? Since we've already run into challenges raising money, is not having funding from the government going to make that even harder?
One of the things that funding from the NEA or a state arts agency for that matter, our reviews are so intensive. Reviews of programs, annual reports, financials, programmatic areas, that if an organization receives a public grant, oftentimes other funders, corporations, foundations, businesses, will look at that as a stamp of approval. We'll quite frankly say this organization has gone through a gauntlet of review that we believe they are worthy of our investment as well. It's important to note that a nonprofit organization raises about 50% of their dollars and earns about 50% of their dollars. Unlike Broadway, which is 100% for profit, when you see a show at a nonprofit theater like Arizona Theater Company or the Mesa Arts Center, that ticket price is, one, lower. They also have ways that they can bring people into their audiences that may not have the resources to pay that ticket price. Mm-hmm. They also have after-school programs, programs for young people, programs for community members, festivals. All of those things are what public dollars provide. Public dollars provide access to the arts.
When we hear budget proposal like this, what do people in their communities, what do organizations like yours and just individuals need to do to try to stem the tide? I presume there's a real push to try to reverse this and not get this to go into effect.
Well, right now, the White House has made their budget clear, and now it moves to Congress. And in Congress, we have a great bipartisan support, which the arts have always had, bipartisan support by congressional leaders on both sides of the aisle. So now we moved into the congressional situation where we have conversations with those individuals about the public value of these organizations that are on the chopping block.
It seems when there is a possibility of a deficit, a growing deficit, wherever it may be, the arts seems to be one of these so-called soft targets. Why do you think that is?
I think it has to do with people misunderstanding maybe the term of arts. Mm. When we're talking arts and humanities, we're simply talking about people engaged in choirs at their church, in plays that their children are participating in arts education, in libraries, all the things that we as Americans value. I think oftentimes the arts are categorized as I call it the Frasier effect, where two snooty guys are going off to the opera and before trying to get tickets to the best restaurant in town. That is not what the arts are about. That is not what the National Endowment for the Arts is about. That's definitely not what the Arizona Commission on the Arts is about. We are about making sure that public dollars reach programs that serve Americans and Arizonans across the spectrum. We see NEA grants in every congressional district in America.
The arts will not die without NEA or NEH funding. Can the arts still in our communities and our households survive without help from NEA and NEH?
If indeed the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Humanities are cut in the administration's budget and the Congress agrees to that, I think we will see an impact on the ability to serve individuals across the country. Quite frankly, these public dollars provide access, as I said before, and without public dollars, that access is not guaranteed. So then what we see is nonprofit organizations acting more like profit organizations and their charitable intent really being subdued.
Bob Booker is executive director of the Arizona Commission on the Arts. We've been talking about President Trump's budget proposal that would eliminate funding for the National Endowment for the Arts.
What is the role of physical books, words printed on paper, in 21st century libraries? ASU is working to figure that out, both as Hayden Library undergoes a renovation, but also through its work on a national program called Book Traces, which aims to find unique copies of old books on library shelves. With me to talk about all this are Jim O'Donnell, university librarian at ASU, and Devaney Lozer. She's an English professor there and organizer of ASU Book Traces. And Devaney, let me start with you. It seems people still want to read books they can hold in their hands rather than just on a Kindle or something.
Absolutely. And I think the many material aspects of the book are really important to communicate to our students who may not have the same love of books and printed pages that many of us who grew up with different media still appreciate.
Yeah, how do you try to sell college students who are millennials generally now on printed words on actual paper?
Yeah, well, the cool part of the Book Traces project is that we're looking for unique features in these books. So it's not just the fact of it being a printed object, but that it has imprints of past readers and past owners that make it unusual and unlike any other copy of that book.
Jim, when you look at sort of where libraries are going, and ASU's Hayden Library is undergoing a renovation, where do printed books fit into sort of the overall scheme of libraries and university libraries?
Anybody tells you they know the answer to that one for sure is lying, but it's clear that the printed book will be with us for a long time and should be. There are things you can only do with a printed book, and there's history you can only touch and reach with the printed object. We're trying to make that a feature of the renovation we're imagining.
So in your mind, how do you do that?
Well, we're working on that. We're trying to learn from retail. We're trying to learn from actual usage. We are aware of many old practices of libraries that don't make much sense. Rip the dust jackets off, turn them spine outwards, put a sticker on them, rebind them if they show the slightest recalcitrance, make them as boring and physically ordinary as you possibly can. Well, that's not the way to get attention.
Well, so, I mean, do you have a sense of how you try to get these books' attention? I mean, I assume you don't want to, like, have fireworks or sparklers coming out of the stacks or anything, but how do you...
talk.
I mean, how do you try to make it so that, you know, students are excited? You can say all you want, you know, this one might have had, you know, a special owner in the past, or it's super old. Like, look at how the, you know, the pages are browning a little bit. That's really cool. But how do you try to get them really excited?
So maybe our whole physically present collection will be more like special collections, subsets chosen because of their coherence and interest, or maybe of their date, or maybe of their binding, more like displays designed to attract your attention, and then maybe some QR codes or whatnot hidden around them that you click on to find out what else we've got that this might lead you to.
Is there a balance to be struck between making the library more interesting and exciting to college students and turning it into like a Pokemon Go stop?
I'm not quite sure anybody is heading towards the Pokemon Go stop. We know that we get 10,000 to 15,000 students a day coming into our Hayden Library at the center of campus. Most of them are coming in to do their assignments, do their work. Sometimes they're even, and I say this as a teacher with great regret, a little bored. We've got the good stuff. We've got the old stuff. We've got the rock and roll stuff. And we want to use the way we present it to attract their attention, challenge them, provoke them, make them think of things they could do that they haven't already thought of, and then provide the structure in which they can take the next step to make real use of it.
Devaney, is this a conversation that's sort of happening beyond just ASU? I mean, is this something that universities across the country are sort of struggling with to some extent?
Absolutely. And Book Traces itself the ASU Local Project. It's part of booktraces.org, a University of Virginia-founded project, trying to get people to return to the stacks of libraries and think about what's there. And think about the fact that whatever copy of the book you see on Google Books is one copy, but that it's not the only valuable copy. It's not the only place where that information can be found. And, of course, that not everything's been digitized.
I mean, do you shudder a little bit when you hear Jim saying that when the renovation of Hayden Library is complete, the physical collection will probably be smaller than it was? There will be fewer physical books in there?
Here's why I don't shudder. I think things are going to be differently discoverable. And anytime you move from one kind of medium to another, you have gains and losses. So, of course, I think there are some losses to having fewer printed books around. But I think there are great gains to selecting interesting things to look at rather than to have shelf after shelf of things that I think students have become kind of blind to or inured to.
Maybe choosing quality over quantity.
Absolutely. Or showcasing different aspects of the library's print collections at different moments. It won't just be a kind of dead real estate.
Jim, I want to go back to something that you mentioned just a minute ago, which is that the different uses of the library, it's not just students going into a library to check out a book or to read a book. What to you is sort of the right balance of the different uses and how the library is comprised of those, and maybe where in the library those different things are located, to make sure that students are making the best use of them and that you are making the best use of the space that you have?
Right now, we know that our traditional stacks aren't working very well. We have 1.5 million books in Hayden Library, and the stacks are deserted because the old-fashioned stack arrangement, there's just too many books per shelf, the shelves are high, the shelves are narrow. This generation doesn't know how to work those stacks the way you did when it was the only way to get information. So we say, let's figure out how to make the presentation of books in the building itself engaging, energizing, connecting, so that students can pursue their work. You know, a building full of books has never been a library. A library is what people do when they're in a building with a lot of books and a lot of information around them. And our focus is on watching and listening to our students and researchers to see what they're actually doing, what they want to do, what they might do that we can help.
I'm curious if either of you think there will ever be a time when libraries do not have physical books in them.
Impossible.
I agree. I don't see that in our future.
Do you think that the number of physical books that are on display in a library, will that continue to shrink? Or do you think sort of where you're going to now will hold for a while?
I think we're going to get to a steady state. I think we'll know what feels like a comfortable, interesting, navigable collection. You know, once upon a time, Arizona State, probably college, only had 350,000 volumes, and it was a wonderful collection to go browsing in. If anything, our collection now is too big. It would take too long to work through all the different subjects you might be interested in.
Devaney, what do you think?
Well, I mean, you think about a museum collection, and, you know, increasingly, I think print is a kind of antique. But a museum collection has a permanent collection and then things that are on display. And I see libraries moving to a model where there will be circulating displays and circulating print aspects that are emphasized and that users are invited to explore and think through.
Devaney Lozer is an English professor at ASU. I was also joined by university librarian Jim O'Donnell.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Terry Neary. I'm a navigator at the Phoenix Airport.
Please board here for Terminal 3 and walkway to Terminal 2.
Navigators are volunteers that help point people in the right direction. And you're going to come into gate B7. Just earlier today, there was a fellow that he got off the plane a little early. He was on a connecting flight, and he was going somewhere else, and he was actually in the wrong airport.
Going down.
We pointed him in the right direction, so I think he'll make it to his final destination. People are generally happy to be traveling, or they're reuniting with someone, you know, picking up someone. So it's just a nice environment to be in.
That's Terry Neary helping people out at Sky Harbor International Airport. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to help us find our way, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick, I'm Mark Brody. The Islamic State claimed responsibility today for the deadly attack outside the British Parliament, though Prime Minister Theresa May said the assailant is a British-born man.
A moment of silence was observed earlier today in London after a deadly attack that left at least three people dead and around 40 others wounded. A British-born man who had previously been investigated by British intelligence for connections to violent extremism plowed a car into crowds of people on Westminster Bridge right near Parliament yesterday afternoon. He also stabbed and killed a police officer. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, calling the assailant a soldier of the caliphate. British Prime Minister Theresa May addressed lawmakers today as she vowed that London would move forward united.
Today we meet as normal, as generations have done before us and as future generations will continue to do, to deliver a simple message. We are not afraid, and our resolve will never waver in the face of terrorism.
A message of calm and unity from British Prime Minister Theresa May there. Joining us now from London is Stephen Farrell, staff editor in the London Bureau for our partner, the New York Times. Hi, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. What do we know about the attacker now and whether this was a lone wolf type inspired actor or somebody who was steered by ISIS directly?
Well, all of that's being figured out at the moment by the police and the domestic security services. What we do know is that all public statements about the actual events were that it was one person involved on the ground, driving a vehicle into a crowd of people on Westminster Bridge, then ramming the car into the railings around Parliament. What we have found out this morning, we all woke up in London to find out that police had raided a number of addresses around the country and that eight arrests had been made in London and Birmingham, a city in the Midlands, a couple of hours' drive away from London. So nobody, of course, knows what will come of those arrests, but it does suggest that they knew where they wanted to go, they knew who they were looking for very quickly after the event, and we are hearing that the suspect was British-born, but no more than that, other than there was some historic involvement with the security services. They were aware of him.
This is the first attack of significance since the London underground bombing in the summer of 2005. Has London on edge again, or at least sat up to take notice of terrorism once again?
Yeah, I mean, there was a British soldier nearly beheaded. He's murdered on the streets a couple of years back. These things have gone on. It was interesting. Everybody kind of pricked up their ears last year when the outgoing head of the London police said, look, it's a matter of when, not if. So to an extent, the British authorities have kind of been pricing this in, preparing people for it. It didn't really come as a surprise, certainly not after all the attacks on the continent. Pretty much everyone I knew has been walking around London wondering when's it going to come.
The geographic significance of the attack, if people aren't familiar with the map of London, the Westminster Bridge is a location of great import symbolically and for tourists.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you're right in the centre of London. It is the bridge that runs right underneath Big Ben, the Houses of Parliament. When I ran down to the scene, well, actually, I was on a motorbike. I whizzed down to the scene yesterday, got off right next to Parliament Square, the statue of Winston Churchill outside those grand Houses of Parliament. I saw a red air ambulance parked in the middle of there, and it you couldn't be closer. The police were shouting us, "We need you to get back. We need you to get back. We need you to get back beyond Downing Street." So right there, you know, this is the heart of the British establishment.
It is. Police investigate in the aftermath of a terrorist attack that killed at least three in London. Stephen Farrell with the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway.
Remember the number one rule in the car business? The customer always has to feel like he won. This is where the negotiating begins. Because of the number one rule in the car business, you can always go down in price, but you can never, ever go back up. Because of the number one rule.
You know there's three number one rules, right?
That's from the trailer for the new movie, Car Dogs. It's being released this week and stars George Lopez, Nia Vardalos, and Patrick J. Adams. The movie follows the sales team at a car dealership as it faces a nearly impossible deadline. Car Dogs was filmed in the Valley, and the crew was a mixture of Hollywood pros and ASU students. With me to talk about the movie and life on the set are Adam Collis, a film professor at ASU. He's also a filmmaker, director, and producer. I'm also joined by Lisa Vargas, who was a film student at ASU and worked on the movie. She's now getting her master's. And Adam, let me start with you. How exactly did this project come to be?
About 5 years ago or so, I was teaching here, and one day, my boss, Jake Penholster, who ran the School of Film, Dance, and Theater, came to me and said, Adam, we need to get our underclassmen what are called production credits, get them on a film set in order for them to graduate. And he wanted me to put them on my seniors' films. And I told him I don't have nearly enough senior films to take care of all that many students because the program was exploding. And I looked to Jake and I said, I don't know how we can solve this. And jokingly, I said, but if we make a feature film, we could just give them all internships and take care of it in one fell swoop. And ASU being the place that it is, Jake took me seriously. And he said, you got a script?
Lisa, what was your role on the film?
I was George Lopez's assistant, and I was also a production assistant. So I worked like really closely with the assistant director's department, make sure set was going good, make sure everybody had their coffee. So,
yeah, what kinds of stuff specifically were you tasked with doing?
Oh, man, we would do a lot of paperwork behind the scenes. In pre-production, we were already learning how to do the type of paperwork that goes on the set. So we learned about setting background. We learned how to, you know, kind of keep everyone quiet on the noise level. So,
just so you're listening, like setting background means handling the extras that are so important. We have so many Phoenix-based actors who served as extras on the film, which is so exciting.
It was all about getting the next thing done.
It sounds like almost sort of learning what goes on the set of a movie and learning how to sort of navigate your way through what needs to happen.
It really was. It really was. Every day was like a different plan and it was a different lesson each day.
Adam, was it a challenge to convince somebody like, say, George Lopez that he wanted to do a movie with a bunch of students working as the crew?
I'm in love with George Lopez. I love the man. And he was totally game. For people like George Lopez, for Nia Vardalos, and so many other veteran Hollywood professionals who contributed to this, they just really kind of fell in love with the idea of teaching students while making a movie. And it was really kind of a love fest in that regard.
Did you feel pressure, though, even though everybody seemed to be on board with the concept here, did you feel pressure that your students really had to know what they were doing and not screw things up, not delay things, not tick anybody off?
Oh, man, I got to tell you about the second day. So we had a great Hollywood first assistant director named Sean Hoban, who'd done films like The Matrix and Mad Men, the television show, Breaking Bad, and he gave us a really easy day. The first assistant director schedules the shoot, and he gave us a really easy first. Remember that?
He did, yes. It was real easy.
Right.
Out in the parking lot, and he really gave us, like, a intro to what we were going to be doing on set to his students. So, I mean, we didn't start, like, right out of the gate, you know,
running on production. Yeah, some orientation kind of
stuff. Yeah, exactly.
But now, do you remember day two?
Oh, gosh.
I can tell you about day two. So, day two was made, I haven't made a lot of movies, but it was easily the hardest shooting day I've ever had in my life.
Right.
And I'm not sure, there must have been some genius that Sean had behind scheduling an incredibly complex day. The first day for our lead actor, Patrick J. Adams, a shoot day that involved all, I think, eight of our principal actors that had something like 40 different setups. And to your question about was I concerned or felt pressure about whether we could work it out with the students? Well, I felt a lot of pressure on that day in a huge way. And were it not for just the awesome esprit de corps on the crew, both with the Hollywood professionals and the students, they just stuck right in it. And we got through that day. And I knew once we got through day two, we were going to be fine.
Lisa, did you feel any pressure? I mean, you were working directly with George Lopez, this guy that you've probably seen on TV,
right.
Seen him in movies, and you were, like, directly responsible for helping him out.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it was a point I felt honored that responsibility was given to me, especially as a new student with, you know, no experience whatsoever in the professional capacity. But everybody on set that was teaching us about these positions, they were just so patient. So it was definitely a student environment, even though we really did have a job to get done.
What do you think are the biggest things that you learned from this experience? Like, what did you take away from this that you think will help you down the road?
Oh, definitely to be able to speak to different people on set. You're going to talk to your director differently than you talk to your talent. You're going to talk to your assistant director differently than you speak to your director. So just being able to change through all those ways, and then also the sense of urgency. You always need to take a sense of urgency and purpose with you whenever you're accomplishing a task.
I'll tell you, to address both of those, the sense of urgency and then the other issue of what I call sort of professional etiquettes and protocols that you just can't teach. I'm a film professor, and I can teach people about where to put the camera, what to put in the frame, how to tell a story visually. But man, you just cannot teach the intangibles like set etiquette. What are the protocols? How do you speak to this person versus that person? And also this sense of urgency, or really sense of purpose, right, that you have to have on a professional film set.
How much of a role did ASU's geographical location play in your ability to do this? I mean, we're a short flight away from LA, where a lot of these folks live and work and sort of ply their trade. Would this have been possible if you had been farther away from sort of the center of filmmaking?
Well, not without a tax incentive. You know, most Hollywood productions now are going to Georgia or to other states with really big tax incentives. You know, the reasons why we brought the production to Arizona really related more to, like, serendipity. It just felt right. The timing, it all just lined up. You know, Mark, the writer, was from Scottsdale. He went to ASU. My students needed this project, which could be made inexpensively, keeping in mind that in 2008, right after the economic crisis, you know, there would be used car dealerships and new car dealerships that have been abandoned because of the economic crisis, and that we might be able to find our location inexpensively. Of course, we found one nested right underneath Papago Park. And so to have that creatively, this feels like a real Arizona movie to me.
Lisa, how do you think your experience on this set, working on this movie, having your name in the credits, how will that help you down the road, do you think?
Oh, man. I mean, this was such a substantial project with ASU, and we had, you know, real talent on this film as well. And to see my name in the credits at the end, people are going to know who I worked with and who I worked under and who I gained my new skills from and how I gained those new skills. So, I mean, that's only going to propel my career in the future. And, I mean, it also creates, like, a network. I mean, you see who I worked with, then, hey, she worked with George Lopez. I mean, it has helped me down the line.
Well, Adam and Lisa, thank you very much for coming in.
Cool. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah,
thank you.
Adam Collis is a film professor at ASU, as well as a filmmaker, director, and producer. We also heard from Lisa Vargas, who was a film student at ASU and worked on the movie. Car Dogs will be released on Friday.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.